from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Russia warned yesterday that it would treat aircraft from the U.S.-led coalition in Syria as potential targets. The decision comes on the heels of escalating tensions in the region after the U.S. shot down a Syrian military plane over the weekend. And now Australia, one of the coalition partners, has suspended all air operations in response to the conflict. We'll discuss the latest developments in Syria and U.S.-Russia relations, all coming up after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. On Monday, Russia warned the United States that any planes belonging to the U.S.-led coalition that fly west of the Euphrates River would be potential targets. The move came after a U.S. warplane downed a Syrian military plane on Sunday, killing the pilot. Meanwhile, Iran said on Sunday that it launched missiles into eastern Syria, targeting Islamic State fighters in retaliation for attacks that hit Tehran on June 7th. Forum this hour will discuss the latest developments in the Syrian conflict, now in its sixth year, and we also want to discuss potential next steps in U.S. policy towards Syria, a country the size of Washington State. Joining us for the hour, Aaron David Miller, Vice President for New Initiatives and a distinguished fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center in D.C. He served for two decades as a State Department analyst, a negotiator, and advisor on Middle East issues. And welcome, Aaron David Miller. Glad to have you back with us.
Pleasure to be here, Michael.
We also have Steve Heiderman with us. Stephen Heiderman is professor in Middle East Studies at Smith College and joins us by phone this morning as well. And Stephen Heiderman, good to have you.
I'm pleased to be with you. Thanks.
Thank you both for being with us. And Aaron David Miller, let me begin with you, if I may. Things are escalating, and they're escalating in ways that really ought to be of great concern, not only after the Syrian jet was shot down, but United States apparently had a reconnaissance plane that was buzzed within about 5 feet earlier today. A Syrian drone was shot down. In other words, things are escalating, and one has to ask, first of all, where's the United States in all of this? It seems as if we're back where we were in terms of being anti-Assad.
You know, I think Syria is a problem, frankly, without resolution now and for the foreseeable future. And I think this administration, like its predecessor, is groping to find the balance between doing too much and not doing anything at all. That is to say, the balance between risk readiness and risk aversion. On the broader issue of what the Trump administration policy is toward Syria, I think it's actually still quite opaque. If you talk to administration officials, the president has made clear, as has H.R. McMaster and Secretary of Defense Mattis, that the key objective is still defeating, or to use the president's word, eradicating the Islamic State. And they have, to a large degree, with some success, compartmentalized their policies to avoid opening up second, third, and fourth fronts. What's new in all this, of course, is the possibility of escalation, not just with the Russians and the Assad regime, but with the Iranians as well. The question is whether or not this is some new, a leading edge of some new campaign to give the Americans more leverage and project their power on the ground, or whether or not this is just another cruel turn in what is becoming a prolonged war and a very crowded battle space. And I'm not persuaded, nor am I willing right now, to jump to the conclusions that we're on the precipice or on the cusp of a major confrontation with the Russians, with the Assad regime, or with the Iranians. This is very much, I think, reflects the administration's policy or the absence of a policy.
Well, that was what I was going to say. Where is the strategy here? There was talk certainly about hands-off earlier in the Trump presidency, and now it almost appears as if things have been turned over to the Pentagon, and which has also happened in Afghanistan. And indeed, if that is the case, then one has to wonder, is there a strategy? And if the strategy seems to be almost echoing what was done in the Obama administration, the only thing, as you suggested, that is different here is stepping up, perhaps, the war against ISIS. But one also has to ask, and I'll ask you, Aaron, is Russia doing much in the way of fighting against ISIS, or are they mainly fighting on the behalf of the Syrians along with Iran?
No, I think, I'm sure Steve will agree, maybe not, that the Russian objective under the cover of fighting Islamic extremism and transnational jihadi terror has basically been to prop up the regime. And I don't believe that Russia's policy has fundamentally changed and been altered. They are trying to get us and have been trying to get us since the intervention in 2015 to make a choice. To make a choice between Assad, between fighting, confronting Assad, and fighting and confronting ISIS. And frankly, I think the Russian strategy, even though it's not a happy hand that they have to play, is essentially working. I think the Obama administration, toward the end of its term, came to the realization that they had no, or they didn't want to implement a policy that was more comprehensive to remove Assad as well as fight the Islamic State. And frankly, I think the Trump administration, in large part because Mr. Trump does not want a confrontation or a proxy war with the Russians on the ground in Syria for many different reasons, some of which I can explain, perhaps some of which I can't. He's also come to the conclusion, despite the rhetoric that Assad must go and that we're not going to accept him, I think he's also acquiesced in the main to the reality that they're prepared to accept. Yes, Assad's part of the problem, but I think they're prepared to accept the fact that he's also part, even though most Syrians would certainly not agree, most people wouldn't agree, that he's part of the solution as well.
If there's going to be any kind of political solution, we can talk about that in the course of this hour. But let me go to Stephen Heidemann on just the sense of escalating conflict. Deconfliction channel down, that is, you know, a channel that would avoid midair warplanes between the United States and Russia, and Russia saying treat U.S. combat planes in Syria airspace as aggressors. This all sounds really volatile to me. I mean, I recognize the fact that there may be all kinds of things going on with the Trump administration in Russia that we can't see and have simply not been revealed to us, but there's a volatility here and a seriousness potentially escalating that could really quite easily get out of hand.
Well, I think you're right. The rhetoric is certainly intended to signal on Russia's part that the U.S. has taken a very risky path in directly confronting the Assad regime, and that Russia is prepared to escalate in turn in response to what the U.S. did yesterday in Syria. On the other hand, alongside of the rhetoric that we're hearing out of Moscow, what we hear from officials, from U.S. officials, is that the deconfliction channels remain open, that we have not seen any signaling from Russian ground units that they're directing additional attention toward U.S. aircraft with an aggressive intent, and that the U.S. has adjusted its operations over eastern Syria in a much more risk-averse profile in order just to test out and sound out this period in which the conditions are much more volatile. And so it seems to me that what we've seen following this incident, and this is consistent with previous encounters between the U.S. and the regime and Russia over Syria, is that following the encounter, we hear some aggressive bellicose rhetoric out of Russia. But facts on the ground and conditions on the ground tend to acknowledge the volatility and evidence some concern at tempering it. And we have to hope that will create the conditions for the rapid restoration of the formal deconfliction channels that the Russians have temporarily cut off. So I share Aaron's sense. I think we have to be nervous whenever we have this many actors actively engaged in a relatively small battle space with competing agendas, and where the potential for something to spin out of control is very high. But what we've seen from both the U.S. and Russia thus far suggests an awareness of how volatile conditions are and a keen interest in creating the possibility that something might happen that neither side really wants.
Well, let me talk about what may happen, because although one can only speculate vis-a-vis Syria and things continue to spin out of control, and as you said, there are so many actors, nevertheless, the Syrians are taking territory away from the retreating ISIS militants, not only in Aleppo in the countryside, but actually they've moved into Raqqa. They're taking oil fields. They're taking villages from ISIS after ISIS had been there for 3 years. And the fact is that presumably they would want the United States out of there because they want to continue to take territory and establish themselves with the Assad regime being hegemonic once again. That seems to be at least what's playing out here, doesn't it?
I think it's what's playing out, and what's crucial to understand about the regime's interest in capturing territory in the East is that it demonstrates the limits of this approach that the Trump administration has taken of avoiding what Aaron described as a comprehensive approach in which it would pursue a solution both including the Assad regime and dealing with ISIS. The focus on ISIS is no longer viable as a strategy, as an exclusive strategy for the United States, because the Assad regime recognizes that it needs to prevent any alternative authority from establishing control over any part of Syrian national territory if it wants to avoid being in a position in which it might later have to bargain to restore its authority over that territory with some actor, whether Syrian actors or international actors. And so the battle against ISIS and the strategy of the Assad regime now make the approach of the U.S., which has been to avoid engaging the Assad regime, more or less obsolete. And if the U.S. wants to continue to persecute its campaign against ISIS, I'm afraid it's going to find itself increasingly at odds with the Assad regime. And we have to recognize that this is a trend that is going to become more and more prominent as the conflict in the East continues.
Stephen Heidemann, again, is professor in Middle East Studies at Smith College. Aaron David Miller is also with us, vice president for New Initiatives and a distinguished fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center. And I've got to ask you, Aaron, I was reading something by Janine DiGiovanni, who is Middle East editor at Newsweek, and she's been 25 years working as a journalist in the field in places like Sarajevo and Rwanda, Srebrenica, Grozny, and so forth. She says that this is one of the most insoluble conflicts that we've faced, and one wonders, especially with what we're talking about here as we try to unravel all the players and so forth, if there can be any kind of resolution, if there's a really, I mean, when one thinks of the refugee problem, one thinks of the people suffering within Syria, it's heartbreaking, and you want to try to bring something to a resolution. Is there no resolution, at least even plausible at this point?
You know, in large part, it's very practical. It's also a very philosophical issue. There are those who argue, I'm not one of them, that if the United States had asserted leadership earlier in the conflict, or perhaps even now, and committed itself to a profound engagement in Syria, mobilizing the international community, mobilizing the resources, the peacekeepers, the vision, the will, the commitment to actually transform this issue, not to fundamentally fix it. You can't take a country that's broken and devastated over a period of 6 years.
Forgive me, Aaron, it started as a civil war, and there still is that division within Syria. There's no way to allay that.
There is indeed. But I see Syria as also part of a broader problem, and that is you have a region in transformation. You have four Arab states, Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Yemen, who are in various stages of dysfunction. You have numerous other Arab states, including Egypt, which is under severe economic and political pressure, and you're likely to see more instability in the years ahead. So Syria is part of a broader piece. And as far as the United States is concerned, it's not that I've abandoned my faith in the U.S. capacity to lead and to commit itself. I just look at this region and wonder. We are stuck in a region, and this, in my judgment, is our dilemma, that we cannot transform and we cannot extricate ourselves from, which means we have to find the middle ground. And the middle ground has been elusive. That is to say, how do you transact? How do you identify what core American interests are, drill down, try to protect them, and do what you can to cope and to adjust with a region in transition to a future that's very difficult to predict. So one additional point on the humanitarian issue. Syria is a moral humanitarian catastrophe. I mean, nobody looking at the situation could reach any other conclusion. The scale of destruction, devastation, displaced people, refugee flows, torture, murder, an entire generation.
Chemical weaponry.
Scarred by this. But I just urge people to understand, and I'm not an expert on Syria, but I am something of an authority on us and the way we behave. Syria is not our response to Syria is not the norm of our response to other humanitarian and moral catastrophes. You know, you can start from the Armenian genocide through the Holocaust, through Rwanda, to Cambodia, to Sudan, to Darfur, to Congo. Bosnia may be the exception. The U.S. has not interceded over the course of decades in response to situations like this, even when our national interests, as in this case they are, whether they're vital or not is arguable, but our national interests are involved here. It's the exception, the humanitarian intervention, not the rule. So we can pillory the Obama administration and Washington all we want, but we ought to take a good long look in the mirror at ourselves and why we do and more importantly, do not intercede in these sorts of situations.
Well, at this point, and let me ask you this, Stephen Heidemann, how much would intercession really be in order or really help avail what has become? I mean, particularly when you think of today's World Refugee Day, and I just can't help thinking about the extraordinary problem that we have with refugees trying to escape from Syria and find someplace that they can be safe. It's an ongoing crisis and, as Aaron said, a catastrophe. How much can the United States really even do, especially when you've got Iran involved now and you've got al-Nusra and you've got al-Qaeda and you've got ISIS and different factions within Syria?
Well, first, I think it's important to underscore that the scale of U.S. intervention in Syria, particularly as it focuses on the Syrian uprising, which was initially not a civil war, but a nationwide uprising organized in the form of peaceful protests that was militarized in large part because of the regime's use of violence against unarmed civilians. But that the scale of U.S. intervention in support of that uprising has been very, very modest. By far, the most significant component of U.S. Engagement in the Syrian crisis has been on the humanitarian side, where the U.S. is the single largest provider of humanitarian assistance to those displaced in need and refugees created by the conflict. So we've done relatively little on the military side. I do happen to...
Well, forgive me, Stephen, until Trump became president and decided to send missiles over there. I mean, this was unprecedented.
Even under Trump. Trump, in fact, went much further than the Obama administration in curtailing military support for the armed anti-Assad opposition, which had been benefiting from very modest levels of military support from the U.S. government under Obama. That was cut off under Trump. What has escalated is the campaign against ISIS. And U.S. officials, the Trump administration, has been very clear that its priority in Syria is ISIS, not the regime. And if we can imagine that you can solve the Syrian crisis by getting rid of ISIS, that makes sense. I don't believe that. But in terms of the scale of intervention and what the U.S. can accomplish, it's a very important question, because without a clear sense of a political outcome that the U.S. would like to try to move toward in Syria, this escalation on the ground is really disconnected from any broader political strategy. It's a point you emphasized in your opening, and I find that to be very dangerous. And I think in responding to Aaron's comment about our capacity to achieve relatively little in these contexts, and broadly speaking, I don't think that's wrong. It seems to me that the U.S. has for some time operated with a political vision, at least under the Obama administration, that was not in any sense excessive in its ambitions. What the U.S. hoped to achieve under Obama was a very limited political transition that would, over some period of time, result in a political system that provided more space for the opposition to the Assad regime to participate, that constrained the authority of the Assad regime to some extent, and that responded to the grievances that launched the uprising in 2011, potentially by devolving more power to local actors on the ground in Syria, which has been enormously centralized in the way it was run. Now, that is not a grandiose vision for democracy and market capitalism in Syria. It's a very, I think, realistic sense of where it might have been possible to move Syria. But to get there requires a strategy. It requires diplomatic resources, which are completely absent under the Trump administration. And it requires recognizing the links between the campaign against ISIS and dealing with the abuses and the violations of international law, the atrocities committed by the Assad regime. We're increasingly finding, as I noted before, that those are problems that are becoming linked in this ongoing operation in the East, because the Assad regime understands that if any alternative authority is able to gain a foothold in areas liberated from ISIS, it will face a much more difficult political environment in the future than if it is able to establish its own control over those territories again in the near future. That's why it's so determined to go against the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces now. That's why it, with its allies Iran and Russia, are so determined to hem in the United States in the east of Syria, because it recognizes the cost, the political cost in the long run, of not ensuring its own control over those areas. So I think I see intervention as potentially creating leverage to achieve a reasonable, modest process of political transition in Syria, but it won't happen if we don't have a strategic framework guiding what we do on the ground. And right now, my big concern is that that framework isn't there.
And once again, Stephen Heidemann is professor in Middle East Studies at Smith College, and we do want to hear from you, and we want you involved in this conversation. Let me tell you how you can indeed participate. You can join the discussion by calling our toll-free number now. It's 866-733-6786. Again, the number to join us, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, feel free to join the program by phone. You can also post comments and questions onto our website or Facebook page and email us, kqedtalk@gmail.com. And please note that's a different email than normal, kqedtalk@gmail.com. We do want to hear from you as we continue to talk about the ongoing escalating tensions and the serious and in many ways profound volatility in Syria and the crisis that goes along with it, the ongoing crisis of refugees and the ongoing crisis internally of citizens living within Syria. We do want to hear your thoughts and any questions or comments you might have. And we'll return to you when we return. Aaron David Miller with us, Vice President for New Initiatives and a distinguished fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center, for many years with the State Department as a negotiator, advisor, and analyst. And Stephen Heidemann, Professor in Middle East Studies at Smith College. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our focus this hour is on Syria, and we do want to hear from you, your thoughts about the ongoing and escalating conflict there, any questions you may have for our guests, Aaron David Miller and Stephen Heidemann, and we do welcome your involvement. Our toll-free number again is 866-733-6786, or you can go to our Facebook page and put questions or comments there, or post them onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and we have a different email, kqedtalk@gmail.com. We do want your involvement in the program, so please feel free to join us. We're going to be joined now by Ahmad Diab, who is an assistant professor of Arabic literature at UC Berkeley and who is Syrian-born. He's of Palestinian descent but grew up in Syria. And Ahmad Diab, good to have you with us. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
I guess from someone who grew up in Syria, I'd like to hear your sense of what's going on there now and what maybe you can communicate to our listeners about not only the trauma, the horror, the internal divisions and so forth, but where maybe there is a possibility of bringing about some kind of reconciliation or some kind of movement toward peace.
Well, the kind of reconciliation that's possible at the moment is forced reconciliation, in the sense that the regime-held areas are enjoying relative calm, but it's worse than it used to be under during their regular dictatorship time, if you will. The rest of the country is far less stable, and in the short term, there's really little chance of anything major changing. Broader regional puzzle pieces are getting more complicated, as I believe your guests have tried to illustrate. But something that I think will play out perhaps more in a more intensified manner is what's happening in the Gulf states between Qatar and the on one side and Saudi Arabia, Emirates, and Egypt on the other. And I think a lot of Syrians are worried that their country will continue to be a proxy battlefield for all these competing interests.
Professor Diab, I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, we're well aware, and I know you are acutely aware, as anybody from Syria is, of the suffering and the violence. But a lot of this, unfortunately, goes on between, or is exacerbated by the kind of tensions that are existing, particularly between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
It's Saudi Arabia and Iran, absolutely, but it's also the U.S. and Russia. It's also Turkey and the
yes.
Kurds.
Yes.
It's to narrow it down to any one axis. It's I have a hard time doing that.
Well, but all of these conflicts, notwithstanding, you know, it's the Syrian people who are suffering the most. That's something that really has to be kept present and primary in the minds and hearts here. I think, in fact,
absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely, and I listen as. As someone who lives in this country, has lived in this country for quite a while, I do find it problematic, the sense of moral superiority that is claimed by various parties here. The history of the U.S. is for the rest of the world, for an outsider, for someone who's had the who's benefited from the educational system in the U.S. and who's interacted and had conversations with a lot of Americans over the years. There's a tendency to, and other countries do that too, to forget the not so bright moments in one's own history. You know, I'm thinking of 1956 in Hungary. I don't think the Eisenhower administration was did much to help the Hungarians who rose up against the Soviet Union. Something similar happened in the 90s in Iraq when the Iraqis rose up against Saddam and they were left to die. And I just would like for these instances that are quite illustrative or equally illustrative in how the U.S. has conducted business around the world. Various U.S. administrations over half a century have disregarded human suffering.
I think you're suggesting maybe more intervention by the United States. Is that what you're leading up to here?
Not necessarily. No, I'm not necessarily. I mean, look at South Sudan. You know, the U.S. has helped create a whole new country, and South Sudan is a catastrophe right now. It's it has a refugee problem that can compete with the Syrian refugee problem. I'm not suggesting that more U.S. intervention is necessarily the way to go. I'm suggesting that some self-inspection on the parts of U.S. policymakers would perhaps do some good, The assumption that an American intervention is necessarily going to be an intervention for the good of the people on the ground does. I mean, where has that happened in the last 20 years?
There's a very profound question. Professor Diab, it's good to have you with us, and I appreciate your joining us this morning on Forum. And again, Ahmed Diab is the Assistant Professor of Arabic Literature here at UC Berkeley. And let me bring some of our callers in here. This is Ida, who is a Syrian-American. Ida, go ahead. Please, join us.
Well, hi, Michael. Thanks for a great, great program.
Thank you.
Well, as I said, I was raised in Damascus. My mom's American. My father's Syrian. And I wanted to just bring up one point, is that ISIS is not Syrian. ISIS is a collection of distraught Afghanis, Iranian mercenaries, Lebanese crazies. I mean, it's a whole cocktail. And to say that we are trying to get rid of them in Syria is just part of it, because the regime loves them. That gives them air cover. It makes them look legitimate. They want to be an international player. Assad doesn't want to be. Putin wants to look like the fantastic Superman. It's working for them, but it's not working for us, the Syrians.
Well, I thank you for that comment. You know, Assad is of a different, ISIS are mainly Sunnis, and his brand of Islam is much more allied with Iran and with Shia Muslims. But as a question, and let me go to you on this, Aaron David Miller. Noel says, why can't we work on Russia on this? Is the national security establishment so vehemently anti-Russian that they won't consider that? I think it's a pertinent question, particularly in the light of the fact that certainly during the campaign, President Trump was sounding as if he wanted to work with Russia and, you know, had, shall we say, goodwill toward Putin.
I think by and large that is still the case for reasons that are difficult to divine. I think the president clearly, if there were an opportunity, would like to figure out a way to do precisely that. I would just urge caution here. And it's not just a function of the Trump administration. It goes back clearly through Obama and through to George W. Bush as well. There is a fundamental disconnect on many issues between what Vladimir Putin wants for his country and what we want with respect to foreign policy. And I think that's going to ensure a limited basis of cooperation, not a hopeless basis, but a limited basis of cooperation between the United States and Russia. Second is the issue of whether or not, and we could argue this, Mr. Putin requires, in order to maintain domestic legitimacy at home, a adversarial relationship with the United States. And I think in part that's important to his domestic base and to his conception and his self-image of reasserting Russian influence and prestige. He has seen far too many Russian friends, from Saddam Hussein to Muammar Gaddafi, dispatched by the United States. And I think much of what Putin does is an effort to block the United States from imposing its vision and its will in any number of areas, not just in the Middle East, but you saw it in Crimea, well, you saw it in Ukraine for sure. So I think that the prospects for U.S.-Russian cooperation on the transformative scale to actually broker a grand design to end the Syrian civil war, I think is quite limited.
You mentioned Ukraine, and I should probably insert here for listeners' benefit that there is a meeting going on, I believe, today between the head of Ukraine and Vice President Pence. And this is, shall we say, the other side of Ukraine from the Paul Manafort support for Ukraine that's meeting with Vice President Pence. I want to read a comment from a listener named Andrew, since we've been talking about whether the United States, and I'll go to more of your calls, whether the United States should in any way intercede. And Andrew writes, considering how long the entire region has been going to you-know-where in a handbasket, why aren't we pulling out of the region altogether, especially with renewable energy becoming so much more competitive with fossil fuels? Why spend time and money on these countries at all? And we'll go to another caller. Let me go to Saheed, who's joining us this morning. Saheed, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I just agree with the very last comment the gentleman made. The fact that Russia does not have a fleet of aircraft carriers like we do, they must have control of the port in Syria. And unless this issue is somehow resolved, where Russia can control Syria and the Syrian port, I'm afraid everything else that we discussed, ISIS, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Assad, they're all secondary issues and smoke and mirror. And unless, you know, somehow this issue is addressed, where Russia can control the Syrian port, I'm afraid things are looking grim.
Well, I thank you for those comments, as grim as your note is. And let me go back to Professor Heidemann. Stephen Heidemann, actually looking from that call and another listener saying, let me put it to you this way. This listener writes, what is Russia's ideal outcome in Syria? Perhaps the last call can be indeed informative here.
Well, I think Russia does look at Syria on a number of different levels. It does offer them an opportunity to reassert Russian influence in the Middle East as a critical actor. And as a critical actor in addressing what has become a conflict of global proportions, so improving its profile, raising its influence and visibility on the world stage, and doing so in a way that does pose an explicit counterweight to the influence and authority of the United States, and that's clearly one of its aims in Syria. On the other hand, I think it also has, and I think President Putin has very deep principled objections to the U.S. strategy of regime change. I'm reiterating here some of what Aaron mentioned, and is determined that what it views as a very risky strategy that the U.S. has embraced of overthrowing leaders, which in Russia's view has led to violence and chaos on the ground in every context in which it's been attempted and in which it succeeded, Iraq, Libya, in Syria, that this is a leading source of instability in parts of the world where Russia feels it has interests at stake. And so it's directly working to ensure the failure of U.S. attempts to achieve an overthrow of the Assad regime by military force. On the other hand, what's important to know in terms of your caller a moment ago is that almost every actor involved in Syria acknowledges Russia's interests, has been prepared to be responsive to Russian concerns, and as far as I'm aware, there isn't a single actor that has indicated that it would require that Russia withdraw from Syria or give up its access to certain military positions in Syria as part of a political solution. What's been much more important to the United States has been the degree of leverage that the Russian regime exercises, the Russian government exercises over the Assad regime. The U.S. under Obama and now under Trump has looked to Russia to play a critical role in resolving the Syrian crisis. And yet, time and again, what we find is that Russia does not have the kind of leverage over the regime that would be needed in order to get the regime on board, either in a diplomatic process or in curtailing some of its more egregious military activities on the ground. And we saw that both in early April, when the regime launched a chemical weapons attack that the U.S. responded to with a cruise missile strike. And we saw it just now in the east, where the U.S. had warned the Assad regime through Russia to back off on its confrontation with U.S.-backed forces on the ground. And the Assad regime ignored those warnings and went ahead and continued its offensive against U.S.-backed forces. So for me, the critical question about the Russian role in Syria is, what is it reasonable to expect that Assad, that Russia can get Assad to do? How much influence does Russia really have? And at any number of critical instances, the U.S. has been very, very disappointed to find that, in fact, Russia may not have significant influence over the regime. Iran probably has much more influence.
Yeah, I was just thinking that, and I was also thinking of the fact, the analogy to the United States believing that China has a great deal of influence over North Korea. Maybe in a similar way we have been deceived about Russian influence, though it's obviously been very tied to Syria and to the Assad regime and continues to be tied. I want to bring in more of our callers, and let me actually go to Chris, who joins us next. Chris, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks for having me. I just had one comment. It's always interesting to me listening to these very stimulating discussions who's not mentioned. And in this case, for me, it's Saudi Arabia, because it sort of occurs to me, and I may be wrong on this, I'm not a Middle East expert, but it occurs to me that if Saudi Arabia, if the king wanted to put an end to ISIS or cripple ISIS, he could do so pretty easily, if not by decree, then by using the Saudi special services. You know, I mean, in the Arabian Peninsula, obviously Saudi Arabia is kind of the center of Sunni Islam. And I mean, what's their role in all this? I know that in Yemen, you know, it's sort of a proxy war between Iran. Is there a proxy war going on in Syria as well between Saudi Arabia and the Revolutionary Guard? I don't know.
Yeah, thank you for that. And Aaron David Miller, it's a good question. How much are we seeing maybe a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and the Revolutionary Guard in Syria?
I mean, I think there's an element of that. And clearly the Saudis believe, rightly or wrongly, that Iran is their gravest threat in the region. And Syria has clearly become a sort of proxy battlefield. But I'm not sure, I am positive that the Saudi role in, even if the Saudis wanted to commit their resources, their prestige, their authority in the Muslim world, they could not bring ISIS to heel. Nor could they bring, we talk about ISIS, but we forget that we are faced now with a much broader phenomenon of a transnational jihadi groups and movements. Al-Qaeda is making a comeback in Syria, various Al-Qaeda derivatives and affiliates.
And forgive me, Aaron, but I think you can make the argument that ISIS had its growth, obviously had a great deal to do with the war in Iraq, but also with Saudi Wahhabism and Salafism in the attempt to spread it throughout the globe.
And for decades, the Saudis have been exporting under the dawah, the call, through money and educational materials, funding extremist elements and imams and madrasas in from Pakistan to Afghanistan, even to tiny Kosovo. But notwithstanding, I believe even under this risk-ready king and the young Mohammed bin Salman, I find it almost impossible to imagine that the Saudis, frankly, would commit the resources in large part. They've been victims. They've been victims of the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. But they also are hostage to a religious establishment, as you put it, Michael, that shares a good deal of similarity in doctrine to these groups. So I think they're hemmed in, they're constrained, they're unwilling and or unable to commit themselves. You know, I've often wondered.
Yeah, but they'll commit themselves in Yemen. They have committed themselves in Yemen.
Yemen is a different situation, and there it's been a disaster. I mean, I've made the point repeatedly. If the Saudis are so concerned about what's happening to Sunnis in Syria, why don't they commit their own special forces? They have sophisticated military equipment and some highly trained special forces. Why not commit? And I think the answer may be
Russia.
The answer is obvious. They are bogged down in Yemen. They're much more concerned with maintenance of regime control, and unlikely to project that kind of risk beyond their borders.
We also have the Russians to worry about. Let me bring another caller on here, and this is Daryl. Daryl, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to talk a little more about the consequences of not reacting to this crisis, because what's happened in Syria has created the refugee crisis in Europe, has brought a force playing in the Brexit exits, brought Le Pen to the stage, brought Trump and the fears of people coming to our country. I think the consequences of acting are not being acknowledged, and the consequences of these people streaming throughout Europe is not being recognized, and what that impact will have on Western democracy.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. And actually, I'm going to go to Stephen Heidemann here because he just got back from a week in Turkey, and included in that week in Turkey was his being near the Syrian border conducting interviews. Can you speak to that in the refugee problem as you see it, Stephen Heidemann?
Well, I think your caller points quite accurately to the enormous costs of U.S. failure to act, and we see that in perhaps the most dramatic form in this massive refugee problem that has caused such enormous political spillover, both in the region and in Europe. And while we see about a million Syrian refugees overall that have moved into Europe, the number of refugees in surrounding countries is much, much higher. One out of every four residents in Lebanon now is a Syrian refugee. Turkey has taken in close to 3 million Syrian refugees, and almost a million of them are children. And those refugees are putting local communities under enormous strain and represent an enormous burden on the Turkish government, Jordanian government, the Lebanese government. The funds available to respond to the needs of those refugee communities are not nearly sufficient. I think the UN indicates that there'll be a gap of at least 40% between what it has requested and what will be available to support refugee relief programming in the neighboring countries around Syria. And we have to keep in mind that this refugee problem, again, shows us some of the shortcomings and limitations of this policy of disengagement that was embraced by the Obama administration, has been pursued by the Trump administration as well, because the Obama administration rested its approach on the assumption that it was possible to contain spillover from the Syria conflict, that it was possible to keep the effects of that conflict isolated within the borders of Syria. But we've seen anything but that.
Professor Heidemann, excuse me, I'm going to interrupt you because Aaron David Miller has to go within less than a minute here, and I'd like him to respond specifically to what you just said, because I think he may see things through a different lens. Aaron David Miller?
No, I mean, I'm not sure anyone can defend the catastrophe that and the impact and consequences that the Syrian problem has wrought. I would only put it in the perspective, as I tried to do earlier, of what is the exception and what is the norm traditionally through decades of American foreign policy. And the one thing we're not taking into account, and all analysis in of Middle Eastern problems, frankly, doesn't belong just in the Middle East. It belongs in Washington. The Obama administration largely was responding with great risk aversion to Syria, in large part because of its predecessor's risk readiness. And what Congress, the American public, and both the Obama administration and the Trump administration saw in our unbelievably reckless and galactically arrogant decision to invade Iraq, and the consequences of that decision and the logic on which it was based and the implications, 6,000 Americans dead, not to mention scores of thousands of Iraqis, trillions of dollars expended, and what remained of American credibility in two wars in which the United States is still involved and in which the standard for victory is never could we win, but when in fact could we leave and under what circumstances. You must, in considering the American response to Syria and a broken, angry, and dysfunctional Middle East, consider carefully the impact now of Afghanistan and certainly Iraq.
Aaron David Miller, I know you have to go. I appreciate very much your being with us, and thank you for the time you've spent.
Michael, thank you, and it's always good to be on with Steve. He's truly one of the finest analysts of these matters that I know, and thanks again, Michael. You have a terrific show.
Thank you for
likewise,
that.
Likewise, Aaron. Thank you.
Glad to have you both. Grateful to have you both. Actually, Stephen Heidemann, let me go back to you with a tweet from a listener named Carrie who says, Trump and his cronies are simply wagging the dog and diverting our attention from the Russia investigation. We're on the precipice of a proxy war. I don't know if Wen can verify the first part of that statement, but what about the precipice of a proxy war here, Steve Heidemann?
some time, I think, since Syria has been a proxy war. It's been driven so heavily by the interests and activities of regional actors and international actors other than Syrians, that I don't think there's much question at this point that we have agendas at play in the Syrian conflict that vastly transcend Syria itself. The real question about that is whether there is any possibility for these external actors to find any basis for a pathway out of conflict in Syria. And for a period of time, through various diplomatic frameworks, there was some hope that kind of a pathway might become available. What we find ourselves at now is a stage in the conflict in which diplomacy is, in effect, frozen. There is no truly multinational process of diplomacy to resolve the Syrian conflict. We have growing tensions in the East as competition over control of critical territory escalates. And so this proxy war, I think, even though I don't see that we're at risk of spinning out of control, we have to recognize is entering an increasingly very dangerous phase.
Yeah, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Stephen Heidemann, thank you so much for joining us this morning on Forum.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the chance.
Stephen Heidemann is professor in Middle East Studies at Smith College, and we're coming up on another hour of Forum. We're going to talk in the hour ahead with UC Davis professor Bruce Haynes, who's written about three generations of a Harlem family. His memoir is called Down the Upstaircase. Stay tuned for that. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.